sun made a dozen rainbows in the mist flying up from its breaking. All the way to Saul Cove, they were delayed by Garrick, who thought that Demelza could not be going without him, and was convinced that if he persisted long enough, her better nature would come to see the matter as he did. Every few yards, a sharp word of command would send his big lumpy body to the earth, where he would lie in complete and submissive collapse, and only one reproachful bloodshot eye to prove that life still lingered. But a few more dozen paces would show that he was up and following them with slinking, ungainly tread. Fortunately, they met Mark Daniel, who was returning by the path they had come. Mark Daniel was standing no nonsense, and was last seen marching in the direction of Nampara, holding Garrick by one lopsided ear. They crossed the sand and shingle of Saw Cove, meeting one or two people who wished them an affable good day, and climbed the cliff hill at the other side. Before striking inland, they paused for breath, and to watch a flight of gannets diving for fish just off the shore. The gannets manoeuvred beyond the surf, their great stretch of white wings, brown-tipped, balancing them against the press of the wind. Then they would dive plummet fashion, disappearing with a splash, to come up once in 10 or 20 times with a small lance struggling in their long, curved beaks.
"If I was a sand eel," said Demelza, "I should fair hate the sight of a gannet. See 'em fold their wings as they go in. When they come up without anything, don't they look innocent, as if they hadn't really meant it?"
"We could do with some rain now," Ross said, staring at the sky. "The springs are low."
"Some day before I die, Ross, I should dearly like to go a journey on a ship. To France and Cherbourg and Madrid, and perhaps to America. I expect there are all sorts of funny birds out in the sea, bigger than gannets. Why do you never talk about America, Ross?"
"The past is no good to anyone. It is only the present and the future that matter."
"Father knew a man who'd been to America, but he never talked of nothing else. 'Twas half a fairy story, I believe."
"Francis was lucky," Ross said. "He spent a whole summer travelling Italy and the continent. I thought I should like to travel. Then the war came, and I went to America. When I returned, I wanted only my own corner of England. It's strange."
"Someday I should like to visit France."
"We could pay a visit to Roscoff or Cherbourg any time, in one of the St. Anne's cutters. I have done it as a boy."
"I should rather go in a big ship," Demelza said, "and not with the fear of being fired on by the revenue men."
They went on their way. Verity was at the door of Trenwith House, waiting to greet them. She ran forward to kiss Ross, and then Demelza. Demelza held her tight for a moment, then took a deep breath and went in. The first few minutes were trying for them all, but the trial passed. Happily, both Demelza and the Trenwith household were on their best behaviour. Francis had a natural charm when he chose to exercise it, and Aunt Agatha, warmed by a tot of Jamaica rum and crowned with her second-best wig, was affable and coy. Elizabeth was smiling, her flower-like face more lovely for its delicate flush. Geoffrey Charles, aged 3, came stumping forward in his velvet suit, to stand finger in mouth staring at the strangers. Aunt Agatha caused some extra trouble at the outset by denying that she had ever been told of Ross's marriage and by demanding a full explanation. Then she wanted to know Demelza's maiden name.
"What?"
she said.
"Carkeek? Cardew? Carn? Carn, did you say? Where does she come from? Where do you come from, child?"
"Ilagan," said Demelza.
"Where? Oh, that's near the Bassett's place, is it not? You'll know Sir Francis. Intelligent young fellow, they say, but over-concerned with social problems."
Aunt Agatha stroked the whiskers on her chin.
"Come here, bud. I don't bite. How old are you?"
Demelza allowed her hand to be taken.
18.
She glanced at Ross.
Nice age. Nice and sweet at that age.
Aunt Agatha also glanced at Ross, her small eyes wicked among their sheaf of wrinkles.
Know how old I am?
Demelza shook her head.
I'm 91. Last Thursday sennight.
I didn't know you were as old as that, Francis said.
It's not everything you know, my boy. 91 last Thursday sennight. What do you say to that, Ross?
Sweet at any age, Ross said in her ear. Aunt Agatha grinned with pleasure.
You was always a bad boy, like your father. 5 generations of Poldarks I've seen. Nay, 6. There was old Granny Trenwith. I remember her well. She was a Roe. Great Presbyterians, they was. Her father, Owen, was a friend of Cromwell's. They say he was one of the 59 that signed King Charles's death paper. They lost all their land at the Restoration. I remember her well. She died when I was 10. She used to tell me stories of the plague, not as she was ever in it.
We had the plague at Illugan once, ma'am, Demelza said.
Then there was Anna Maria, my mother, who became a Poldark. She was an only child. I was old when she died. Charles Vivian Poldark she married. He was a roamer, an invalid out of the navy from the Battle of La Hogue, before ever he met Mama. And he but 25. That's his portrait, bud. The one with the little beard.
Demelza gazed.
Then there was Claude Henry, my brother, who married Matilda Ellen Peter of Treviles. He died 10 years before his mama. Vomiting and looseness was his trouble. That was your grandfather, Ross. You and Francis makes 5, and little Geoffrey makes 6 generations, and I've scarce been alive any time yet.
Demelza was at last allowed her hand back, and passed on to greet the staring child. Geoffrey Charles was a plump little boy. His face was so smooth that one could not imagine it ever having creased into a thorough-going smile. A handsome child, as might be expected with such parents. Ross's own sight of Elizabeth after 6 months had not been quite as casual or as unemotional as he had hoped and expected. He had hoped to find himself immune, as if his marriage and love for Demelza were the inoculation against some fever of the blood, and this a deliberate contract on his part to prove the cure. But Demelza, he found, was not an inoculation, though she might be a separate fever. He wondered, just at that first greeting, whether after all Demelza's impulse to refuse the invitation had not perhaps been wiser than his own. Their meeting, Elizabeth's and Demelza's, left him with a sense of dissatisfaction. Their manner towards each other was so outwardly friendly and so inwardly wary. He did not know if their greeting deceived anyone else, but it certainly didn't deceive him. Naturalness just was not in it. But Demelza and Verity had taken days to get on friendly terms. Women were like that, however charming taken singly. A first meeting with one of their own kind was an intuitive testing and searching. Elizabeth had given them one of the best bedrooms, looking southwest towards the woods.
"'Tis a handsome house,' said Demelza, dropping her cloak from her shoulders. With the first ordeal over, she felt better. "'Never have I seen the like. 'Tis like a church, that hall. And this bedroom. Look at the birds on the curtains, like missel thrushes. Only the specks are the wrong colour. But, Ross, all those pictures hanging downstairs, I should be afeard of them in the dark.' Are they all of your family, Ross?
I have been told so.
It is more than I can understand that people should wish to have so many dead'uns about them. When I am dead, Ross, I don't want to be hung up to dry like last week's bed linen. I don't want to stare down forever upon a lot of people I've never known at all, great-grandchildren and great-great-great-grandchildren. I'd much sooner be put away and forgot.
This is the second time today you've spoken of dying, Ross said. Do you feel unwell?
No, no. I'm brave enough.
Then oblige me by keeping to some more agreeable subject. What's this box?
That? Said Demelza. Oh, that is something. I asked Judd to bring it over with our night rails.
What is in it?
A dress.
For you?
Yes, Ross.
The riding habit you bought in Truro?
No, Ross, another. You would not like me to be shabby in front of all your great-grandmothers, would you?
He laughed. Is it a dress from the library you have adapted?
No. Verity and me bought this also in Truro, at the same time.
Did she pay for it?
No, Ross. It came out of the money you give us for furnishings.
Deceit, Bud. And you looking so innocent and guileless.
You are stealing Aunt Agatha's name for me.
I think I like it. But I'm just finding the worm in the bud. Deceit and duplicity. Still, I'm glad Verity did not pay. Let me see it.
No, Ross. No, Ross. No, Ross!
Her voice rose to a shriek as she tried to prevent him from reaching the box. He got one hand to it, but she put her arms around his neck and hugged him to stop any further move. He lifted her up by the elbows and kissed her. Then he smacked her twice on the seat and put her down. Where's your good behavior, Bud? They'll think I'm beating you.
Which is the truth? Which is the truth?
She slipped away from him and danced back with the box held behind her.
Go down now, please, Ross. You was not to know anything about it. Maybe I'll not wear it. But I want to try it on, and dinner is in an hour. Go down and talk to Aunt Agatha, and count the whiskers on her chin.
We're not attending a ball, he said. This is just a family party. No need to flig yourself up for it.
It is Christmas Eve. I asked Verity. She said it was right to change my clothes.
Oh, have it as you please. But mind you're ready by 5, and, he added as an afterthought, don't lace your stays too tight, or you'll be incommoded. They feed you well, and I know your appetite. With this he went out, and she was left to make her preparations alone. She did not feel that she need heed Ross's final warning tonight, at any rate. All day she had had recurring bouts of nausea. The Trenwith dinner was safe from her greed. All that was unsafe was the little she might force down. It would be too bad if she made a show of herself this evening. It would be tragic. She wondered if she had to get up from the table in a hurry, where the nearest clothes stall was. She pulled her dress over her head, stepped out of her underskirt, and stood for a moment in the small clothes Verity had lent her, staring at her reflection in the lovely, clear mirror of the dressing table. She had never before in her life seen herself so clearly and so entirely. This reflection was not too shameful. But she wondered how she had had the brazenness to move about and dress with Ross in the room when she was wearing the underclothes of her own and Prudy's devising. She would never wear them again. She had heard it whispered that many good-class townwomen wore white stockings and no drawers. What with hooped skirts, it was disgusting, and they deserved to catch their death. She shivered, but soon she would be unsightly, however dressed. At least she expected so. It was a surprise to her that so far there had been no change. Every morning she took a piece of string with a knot tied in it and measured herself. But unbelievably enough, she seemed so far to have lost half an inch. Perhaps the knot had slipped. A village upbringing had left little out in teaching her the ordinary facts of getting and begetting. Yet when it came to herself, she found gaps in her knowledge. Her mother had borne 6 other children, but she remembered so little of what had happened before she was 8. She must ask Verity. This was now the usual resort for all problems which baffled her. She must ask Verity. It didn't occur to her that there were questions on which Verity might know less than herself. Chapter 8. Downstairs in the large parlour, Ross found only Elizabeth and Geoffrey Charles. They were sitting in front of the fire. Geoffrey Charles was on his mother's knee, and Elizabeth was reading him a story. Ross listened to the cool, cultured voice. There was pleasure for him in that. But she looked up, saw who it was, and stopped.
"Again, Mummy. Tell it again."
"In a little while, darling. I must have a rest. Here is your Uncle Ross come to tell me a story for a change."
"I know no stories except true ones," Ross said. "And they are all sad."
"Not all, surely," said Elizabeth. "Your own must now be happy, with so charming a wife."
Ross hesitated, uncertain whether he wished to discuss Demelza even with Elizabeth. "I'm very glad that you like her."
"She's greatly changed since I last saw her, and that's not 7 months ago, and I think she will change more yet. You must take her into society and bring her out."
"And risk the snubs of women like Mrs. Teague. Thank you. I'm well enough as I am."
"You're too sensitive. Besides, she may want to go out herself. Women have the courage for that sort of thing, and she is yet so young."
"It was with the greatest difficulty that I persuaded her to come here." Elizabeth smiled down on her son's curly head.
"That's understandable."
"Why?"
"Oh, it was meeting the family, wasn't it? And she is a little gauche yet. She would perhaps expect to find antagonisms."
"Mummy, gain, Mummy."
"Not yet. In a while."
"Man's got a mark on his face, Mummy."
"Hush, dear. You must not say such things."
"But he has, Mummy."
"And I've washed it and washed it, and it won't come off," Ross assured him. Thus addressed, Geoffrey Charles fell utterly silent.
"Verity has become very fond of her," Elizabeth said. "We must see more of you now, Ross, now that the ice is broken."
"And what of your own affairs?" Ross said. "Baby Geoffrey is thriving, I see that." Elizabeth put out her small slippered feet and allowed her son to slide from her lap to the floor. There he stood a second, as if about to run off, but seeing Ross's eyes still on him, was overcome with his new shyness and buried his face in his mother's skirt.
"Come, darling, don't be foolish. This is Uncle Ross, like Uncle Warleggan, only more so. He is your true and only uncle, and you mustn't be coy. Up, up, and say how do you do."
But Geoffrey Charles would not move his head. She said,
"I haven't been too well in health, but we are all worried about my poor mother. She's greatly troubled with her eyes. Park, the surgeon from Exeter, is coming to examine her in the new year. Dr. Choke and Dr. Price take a grave view of the disease."
"I'm sorry."
"They say it's a recurrent distemper of the eye. The treatment is most painful. They tie a silk kerchief about her throat and tighten it until she's nearly strangled, and all the blood is forced into her head. Then they bleed her behind the ears. She has gone now to rest with her cousin at Bodmin. I'm very worried."
Ross made a face. "My father had no trust in physicians. I hope you'll have good news." There was silence. Elizabeth bent and whispered in Geoffrey's ear. There was no response for a moment. Then, with a sudden, peculiarly sly glance at Ross, he turned and ran from the room. Elizabeth's eyes followed him.
"Geoffrey is at an awkward age," she said. "He must be cured of his little whimsies." But she spoke in an indulgent voice.
"And Francis?" An expression he had never seen before flitted across her face.
Francis? Oh, we get along. Thank you, Ross.
The summer has gone so quick, and I have intended to come and see you. Francis may have told you I spoke to him once.
You have your own concerns to tend now.
Not to the exclusion of all others.
Well, we have kept our head above water through the summer.
She said this in a tone that went with her expression. The personal pronoun might have referred to the finances of the house, or to the fastness of her own spirit.
I can't understand him, Ross said. We are as we are born. Francis was born a gambler, it seems. If he's not careful, he'll have gamed away all that has come to him and die a pauper.
Every family, thought Ross, has its rakes and its spendthrifts. Their blood was passed on with the rest. Strange taints of impulse and perversity. It was the only explanation. Yet Joshua, even Joshua, who had been eccentric enough and roving in his eye for women, had had the sense to settle down when he got the woman he wanted, and to remain so settled until nature took her from him.
Where does he spend most of his time?
At the Warleggans still. We used to have great fun until the stakes became too high. I have only been twice since Geoffrey was born. Now I'm not invited.
But surely...
Oh, yes, of course. If I asked Francis to take me. But he tells me that they're becoming more exclusively male. I would not enjoy them, he says.
She was staring down at the folds of her blue dress. This was a new Elizabeth who spoke so straightly, in such objective tones, as if painful experience had taught her the lesson of keeping life at a distance.
Ross.
Yes?
I think there is one way in which you might help me, if you would.
Go on.
There are stories concerning Francis. I have no means of knowing what truth there is in them. I could ask George Warleggan, but for a special reason I don't wish to. I have no claim on you, you know that, but I should esteem it so highly if you were able to discover the truth.
Ross stared at her. He had been unwise to come here. He could not sit in calm intimacy with this woman without the return of old sensations.
I'll do anything I can. I shall be pleased to do it. Unfortunately, I don't move in the same set as Francis. My interests.
It could be arranged.
Ross looked at her quickly. How?
I could get George Warleggan to invite you to one of his parties. George likes you.
What's the extent of the rumours?
They say Francis is going with another woman. I don't know what truth there is in it, but it's plain I cannot suddenly choose to go to the parties myself. I cannot... spy on him.
Ross hesitated. Did she realize all she asked? She was, of course, reluctant to spy herself. But that would be his task, in fact, if not in name. And to what end? How could his intervention serve to underpin a marriage if the foundations of the marriage were already gone?
Don't decide now, Ross, she said in a low voice. Leave it. Think it over. I know I'm asking a great deal.
Her tone made him glance round, and Francis came in. Sitting in this big, pleasant parlour, Ross thought, one would soon come to recognise the footstep of everyone in the house as it approached the door.
A tête-à-tête,
Francis said, raising an eyebrow.
And not drinking, Ross. This is a poor hospitality we offer. Let me mix you an eggy hot, to keep away the chills of winter.
Ross was telling me how well his mine is doing, Francis, Elizabeth said.
Lord, save us! Such talk on Christmas Eve!
Francis busied himself.
Come over in January, or maybe February, and tell us about it, Ross. But not now, I implore you. It would be dull to spend this evening comparing notes on copper assays.
Ross saw that he had been drinking, though the signs were very slight. Elizabeth rose.
When cousins have been so long separated, she said pleasantly, it's hard to find something to talk of. It would do us no harm, Francis, if we thought of Grambler a little more.
I must see Geoffrey to bed. She left them. Francis came across with the drink. He was wearing a dark green suit, and the lace at the cuffs was soiled. Unusual in the immaculate Francis. No other sign of the rake's progress. Hair as carefully brushed, stock as neatly tied, manners of a greater elegance. There was an extra fullness of the face, which made him look older, and something superficial in his glance.
"Elizabeth makes life a mortal serious business," he remarked. "Off, as my old father would say."
"Elegance of expression is something I've always admired in you," said Ross. Francis looked up and grinned.
"No offence intended. We have been estranged too long. What's the good of choler in this world? If we took account of every grievance, we should only make more bad blood for the leeches. Drink about."
Ross drank about. "I have no grievances. The past is past, and I'm content enough."
"So you should be,"
Francis said over the rim of his tankard.
"I like your wife. From Verity's account, I thought I should. She walks like a mettlesome colt. And after all, so long as her spirit be good, what does it matter whether she comes from Windsor Castle or Stippy Stappy Lane?"
"You and I have much in common," Ross said.
"I used to think so."
Francis stopped.
"In sentiment or in circumstance, do you mean?"
"In sentiment, I mean. Clearly, in circumstances, you have the advantage of me. The house and interests of our common ancestors. The wife, shall I put it, of our common choice. Money to splash at the card table and the cockpit. A son and heir."
"Stop,"
said Francis,
"or you'll make me weep with envy at my own good fortune."
"I'd never thought it a conspicuous danger in your case, Francis." Francis's forehead puckered in a frown. He set his tankard down.
"No, nor in any case, neither. It's the custom of mankind to judge others in ignorance. They take it."
"Then correct my ignorance." Francis looked at him for a moment or two.
"Pour out my distempers on the eve of Christmas? God forbid. You would find it all so tedious, I assure you. Like Aunt Agatha talking of her kidneys. Finish your drink, man, and have another."
"Thanks," said Ross. "In truth, Francis."
"In truth, Ross."
Francis mocked from the shadows of the sideboard.
"It is all as you say, is it not? A lovely wife, fair as an angel. Indeed, perhaps more of an angel than a wife. The home of our ancestors, hung with their curious visages. Oh, yes, I saw de Melza admiring them open-mouthed. A handsome son brought up in the way he ought to go. Honour thy father and be worshipped by thy mother, that thy days may be long in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. And finally money to splash at the card table and the cockpit. Splash. I like the word. It has a pleasantly expansive sound. One is put in mind of the Prince of Wales dropping a couple of thousand guineas at White's."
"It's a relative word," Ross said evenly. "Like many others. If one is a country squire and lives in the western wilds, one may splash just as effectively with 50 guineas as George with 2,000. Francis laughed as he came back.
"You speak from experience. I'd forgotten. You have been the staid farmer so long I'd quite forgotten."
"Indeed," said Ross. "I should say that ours was far the greater hazard, not only in proportion, but because we have no benevolent parliament to vote £160,000 to pay our debts, or £10,000 a year to squander on the mistress of the moment."
"You're well informed on the business of the court."
"All news flies fast, whether it concerns a prince or a local squire." Francis flushed.
"What do you mean by that?"
Ross raised his mug. "That this drink's very warming to the vitals."
"It may disappoint you to know," said Francis,
that I'm not interested in what a set of braggery pockmarked old grannies are whispering over their turf fires. I go my own way, and leave them to fetch up what poisonous gases they choose. We are none of us immune from their clackings. Look to your own house, Ross.
You misunderstand me, said Ross. I'm not concerned with gossip or the tales of idle women, but the interior of a debtor's prison is damp and smelly. No one would be the worse for your bearing that in mind before it is too late. Francis lit up his long pipe and smoked for some seconds before saying anything more. He dropped a piece of smouldering wood back in the fire and put down the tongs.
Elizabeth must have been pitching you a pretty story.
I don't need her confidences for a pretty story which is known all over the district.
The district knows my own affairs better than I do myself. Perhaps you'd advise me to a solution. Should I join the Methodies and be saved?
My dear man, Ross said, I like you and have an interest in your welfare. But for all it will affect me, you may find your way to the devil by the shortest route. Fortune can provide lands and family, but it can't provide good sense. If you wish to throw away what you have, then throw it away and be damned. Francis eyed him cynically for a moment, then put down his pipe and clapped a hand on his shoulder.
Spoken like a Poldark. We have never been an agreeable family. Let us curse and quarrel in amity. Then we can get drunk in company, you and I together, and to hell with the creditors.
Ross picked up his empty mug and regarded the bottom gravely. Francis's good temper under the quizzing struck a responsive chord. Disappointment, from whatever quarter it had come, had toughened his cousin. It had not changed the essential individual he had known and liked. At that moment, Bartle came in, carrying two branching candlesticks. The yellow games flickered in the draught, and it was as if the firelight had suddenly grown to fill the room. Elizabeth's spinning wheel stood out in the corner, its bobbins shining. A linen doll lay on its back beside the sofa, with stuffing hanging from its stomach. On a chair was a wicker basket with needlework, and a frame with a half-finished sampler. The light of the candles was warm and friendly. With the curtains drawn, there was a sense of cosiness and quiet affluence. In the room were all the signs of feminine occupancy, and there had been about these few minutes of conversation an underlying maleness which drew the two men together by the bond of their larger, wider, more tolerant understanding. Between them was the freemasonry of their sex, a unity of blood, and the memory of old friendships. It occurred to Ross in this moment that half of Elizabeth's worry might be the eternal feminine bogey of insecurity. Francis drank. Francis gambled and lost money. Francis had been seen about with another woman. Not an amiable story, but not an uncommon one. Inconceivable to Ross in this case, and for Elizabeth it had the proportions of a tragedy. But it was unwise to lose one's sense of perspective. Other men drank and gambled. Debts were fashionable. Other men found eyes to admire the beauty which was not theirs by right of marriage, and to overlook the familiar beauty that was. It did not follow that Francis was taking the shortest route to perdition. Anyway, this was Christmas, and the day was intended to mark a family reunion, not to begin a new estrangement. One could go no further. Let it rest. Ross thought of Demelza upstairs, putting on her best and full of youth and good spirits. He hoped she was not going to overdo it. Fortunate that Verity had had the ordering. The thought of Demelza warmed his mind and lit it up, as the arrival of the candles had lit the room. To the devil with vicarious worries. Christmas was no time for them. In January they could be revived, if they still had the power to vex and disturb.
Chapter 9.
Dinner began at 5 and went on until 7:40. It was a meal worthy of the age, the house, and the season. Pea soup to begin, followed by a roast swan with sweet sauce, giblets, mutton steaks, a partridge pie and 4 snipe. The second course was a plum pudding with brandy sauce, tarts, mince pies, custards and cakes, all washed down with the port wine and claret and Madeira and home-brewed ale. Ross felt that there was only one thing missing. Charles. The great paunch, the more or less subdued belches, the heavy good humour. At this moment the corporeal remains of that massive, mediocre, but not unkindly soul were rotting away and becoming one with the soil that had given it life and sustenance. The organic humours of which it was composed would soon be helping to feed the rank couch grass, which overran the churchyard. But in this house, from which he had spent few nights away in the course of his 68 years, in this house remained some unspent aura of his presence, more noticeable to Ross than the aura of all the portraits of 46 ancestors. One did not so much feel sorrow at his absence as a sense of the unfitness of his not being here. For such a small party, the dining hall was too gaunt and draughty. They used the winter parlour, which faced west and was panelled to the ceiling and was convenient for the kitchens. Chance stage-managed Demelza's arrival. Verity had come to the large parlour to tell them that dinner was ready. Elizabeth was there, and the four of them left the room smiling and chattering together. As they did so, Demelza came down the stairs. She was wearing the dress that had been made up from Verity's choice, the very pale mauve silk with the half-length sleeves, slightly hooped and pulled apart like a letter A at the front, to show the flowered apple-green bodice and underskirt. What Ross could not quite understand was her appearance, her manner. Natural that he should be pleased with her. She had never looked so charming before. In her own queer way, this evening she rivaled Elizabeth, who started any such competition with advantages of feature and colouring over almost all women. Some challenge born in the situation had brought out the best of Demelza's good looks, her fine dark eyes, her hair neatly dressed and tied, her very pale olive skin with the warm glow under it. Verity was openly proud of her. At dinner, she didn't burst her stays. In Ross's opinion, she overdid her good behaviour by pecking at many things and always leaving the larger portion on her plate. She outvied Elizabeth, who was always so small an eater. A suspicious person might have thought her to be mocking her hostess. Ross was amused. Tonight she was on her mettle. A talkative girl at meals, full of questions and speculations. She took little part in the conversation at this meal, refused the burnt claret which the others drank, and herself drank only the home-brewed ale. But she didn't look bored, and her manner was always one of intelligent interest, while Elizabeth spoke of people she did not know, or gave some anecdote of Geoffrey Charles. When she was drawn in, she answered pleasantly and naturally and without affectation. Aunt Agatha's occasional broadsides didn't seem to disconcert her. She would look at Ross, who sat next to the old lady, and he would shout an answer. This put the onus on him of finding the right one. Talk turned on whether there was truth in the rumour of another attempt on the king's life. The last such rumour had certainly been true, when Margaret Nicholson tried to stab him at a levee. Francis made some cynical comments on the good cloth used in the royal waistcoat. Elizabeth said that she had been told the king's household servants had not been paid for 12 months. They talked of France and the magnificence of the court there. Francis said he was surprised someone had not tried to sharpen a knife on Louis, who was far more deserving of one than Farmer George. The French queen was trying to find a cure for all her ills in animal magnetism. Verity said she thought she would try that for her catarrh, for she had been told to drink half a pint of seawater daily, and she found she could not stomach it. Dr. Choke blamed all colds on the malignancy of the air. Raw meat put on a pole turned bad in 40 minutes, while similar meat kept in salt water remained fresh for a long time. Ross remarked that Choke was an old woman. Francis said perhaps there was literal truth in that statement, since Polly was so unfruitful. Elizabeth turned the conversation to her mother's eye trouble. Francis drank 10 glasses of port over the meal, but showed little change. A difference, Ross thought, from the old days, when he was always the first under the table.
"Boy's no head for liquor," Charles would grumble.
Ross glanced at Elizabeth, but her look was serene. At 8:15, the ladies rose and left the two men to drink brandy and smoke their pipes at the littered and derelict table. Between themselves, they talked business, but the conversation had not been in progress many minutes when Mrs. Tabb appeared at the door.
"If you please, sir, visitors has just come."
"What?"
"Mr. George Warleggan and Mr. and Mrs. John Treneglis, sir."
Ross felt a spasm of annoyance at having this surprise sprung on him. He had no wish to meet the all-successful George tonight. And he felt sure Ruth would not have come had she known he and Demelza were here. But Francis's surprise was genuine.
"Cock's life! So they come visiting on Christmas Eve, eh? What have you done with them, Emily?"
"They're in the big parlour, sir. Mistress Elizabeth said would you come soon and help entertain them, and they do not intend to stop long."
"Surely. We will go right away."
Francis waved his glass.
"Right away."
When Mrs. Tabb left, he lit his pipe.
"Imagine old George coming tonight. I thought he was spending Christmas at Cardew. A coincidence, what? And John and Ruth? You remember when we used to fight John and Richard, Ross?"
Ross did.
"George Warleggan," said Francis. "Great man. He'll own half of Cornwall before he's done. He and his cousin own more than half of me already."
He laughed.
"The other half he wants but can't have. Some things just won't go on the table."
"His cousin?"
"Carey Warleggan, the banker."
"A pretty name. I've heard him called a moneylender."
"Tut, would you insult the family?"
"The family grows too intrusive for my taste. I prefer a community run on simpler lines."
"They're the people of the future, Ross. Not the worn-out families like the Chenoweths and the Poldarks."
"It's not their vigour I query, but their use of it. If a man has vitality, let him increase his own soul, not set about owning other people's."
"That may be true of Cousin Carey, but it's a small matter hard on George."
"Finish your drink and we'll go," Ross said, thinking of Demelza with these new people to face.
"It is more than a little strange," said Francis. "Philosophers would no doubt hang some doxy name on it, but it seems to me just a plain perversity of life."
"What does?"
"Oh,"
the other hesitated.
"I don't know. We envy some other person for something he has got and we have not. Although, in truth, it may be that he really hasn't it. Do I make myself clear?" "No, I thought not. Let's go and see George."
They rose from the ruins of the feast and walked through into the hall. As they crossed it, they heard shouts of laughter from the large parlour.
"Making a carnival of my house," said Francis. "Can this be George the Elegant?"
"Long odds," said Ross, "on its being John the Master of Hounds." They entered and found his guess a good one. John Treneglis was sitting at Elizabeth's hand-spinning wheel. He was trying to work it. It seemed a simple enough action, but in fact needed practice, which John Treneglis lacked. He would get the wheel going nicely for some moments, but then his foot pressure on the treadle would not be quite even, and the cranked arm would suddenly reverse itself and stop. While it was working right, there was silence in the room, broken only by an interplay between Treneglis and Warlegan. But every time John went off his stroke, there was a roar of laughter. Treneglis was a powerful, clumsy man of 30, with sandy hair, deep-set eyes, and freckled features. He was known as a fine horseman, a first-class shot, the best amateur wrestler in two counties, a dunce at any game needing mental effort, and something of a bully. This evening, though on a social call, he wore an old brown velvet riding coat and strong corduroy breeches. It was his boast that he never wore anything but riding breeches, even in bed. Ross was surprised to see that Demelza was not in the room.
"You lose," said George Warlegan. "You lose. 5 guineas are mine. Ho, Francis!" "One more try, damn! The first was a trial try. I'll not be beat by a comical contraption of this sort."
"Where is Demelza?" said Ross to Verity, who was standing by the door.
"Upstairs. She wished to be left alone for a few moments, so I came down."
"You'll break it, John," said Elizabeth, smiling. "You're too heavy-footed."
"John," said his wife, "get up at once."
But John had been merrying himself with good brandy and took no notice. Once more he got the wheel going, and it seemed that this time he had done the trick. But at the wrong moment he tried to increase the speed, and the cranked arm reversed and everything came to a jerking standstill. George uttered a cry of triumph, and John Treneglis rose in disgust.
3 more times and I should have mastered the pesky thing."
"You must give me a lesson, Elizabeth. Here, man, take your money. It's ill-gotten and will stick in your crop."
"John is so excitable," said his wife. "I fear for your wheel. I think we are all a little foxed, and the Christmas spirit has done the rest."
If John Treneglis set no store by fashion, the same could not be said of the new Mrs. Treneglis. Ruth Teague, the drab little girl of the Easter charity ball, had shot ahead. An instinct in Ross had sensed at the ball that there was more in her than met the eye. She wore a blossom-coloured hoopless dress of Spitalfield silk, with silver spangles at the waist and shoulders. An unsuitable dress for travelling the countryside, but no doubt her wardrobe was well stocked. John would have other calls on his pocket now besides his hunters, and John would not have things all his own way.
"Well, well, Captain Poldark," said Treneglis ironically. "We're neighbours, but this is how we meet. For all we see of you, you might be Robinson Crusoe."
"Oh, but he has his man Friday, dear," said Ruth gently.
"Who? Oh, you mean Judd,"
said Treneglis, blunting the edge of his wife's remark.
"A hairless ape, that. He cheeked me once. Had he not been your servant, I'd have given him a beating. And what of the mine? Old father is cock-a-hoop and speaks of shoveling in the copper."
"Nothing ambitious," Ross said, "but gratifying so far as it goes."
"Egad," said George, "must we talk business? Elizabeth, bring out your harp, let us have a song."
"I have no voice," said Elizabeth, with her lovely slow smile. "If you have a mind to accompany me..."
"We'll all accompany you." George was deferential. "It would suit the night admirable."
Not for George the self-confident uncouthness of John Treneglis, who traced his ancestry back to Robert, Count of Mortain. It was hardly credible that a single generation divided a tough, gnarled old man who sat in a cottage in his shirt sleeves and chewed tobacco and could barely write his name from this cultured young man in the new-fashioned, tight-cut pink coat with buff lapels. Only something of the blacksmith's grandson showed in the size of his features, in the full, tight, possessive lips, in the short neck above the heavy shoulders.
"Is Demelza coming down?"
Ross asked Verity quietly.
"She has not been overawed by these people."
"No, I don't think she knows they're here,"
"Let's have a hand of Pharaoh," said Francis. "I was damned unlucky on Saturday. Fortune cannot always be sulky."
But he was shouted down. Elizabeth must play the harp. They had come specially to hear Elizabeth play. Already George was moving the instrument out of its corner, and John was bringing forward the chair she used. Elizabeth, protesting and smiling, was being persuaded. At that moment, Demelza came in. Demelza was feeling better. She had just lost the dinner she had eaten and the ale she had drunk. The occurrence itself had not been pleasant, but, like the old Roman senators, she was feeling the better for it. The demon nausea had gone with the food and all was well. There was a moment's silence after she entered. It was noticeable then that the guests had been making most of the noise. Then Elizabeth said,
"This is our new cousin, Demelza, Ross's wife."
Demelza was surprised at this influx of people whom she must now meet. She remembered Ruth Teague from seeing her once on a visit to Ross, and she had seen her husband twice out hunting. Squire Treneglos's eldest son, one of the big men of the neighbourhood. When she last saw them both, she had been a long-legged, untidy kitchen wench, for whom neither of them would have spared a second glance. Or Ruth would not. By them, and by George Warleggan, who from his dress she felt must be at least the son of a lord. She was overawed. But she was learning fast that people, even well-bred people like these, had a surprising tendency to take you at your own valuation.
"Damn it, Ross," Treneglos said. "Where have you been hiding this little blossom? It was ungrateful of you to be so close about it. Your servant, ma'am."
Since to reply "your servant, sir," was clearly wrong, besides being too near the truth, Demelza contented herself with a pleasant smile. She allowed herself to be introduced to the other two, then accepted a glass of port from Verity, and gulped half of it down while they were looking the other way.
"So this is your wife, Ross," said Ruth sweetly. "Come and sit by me, my dear. Tell me all about yourself. All the county was talking of you in June."
"Yes," said Demelza. "People dearly love a gossip, don't they, ma'am?"
John roared and slapped his thigh.
"Quite right, mistress. Let's drink a toast. A merry Christmas to us all round, and damnation to the gossips."
"You're drunk, John," said Ruth severely. "You will not be able to sit your horse if we don't leave at once."
"First we must hear Elizabeth play," said George,
who had been exchanging some close confidence with Elizabeth.
"Do you sing, Mistress Poldark?"
asked John.
"Me?" said Demelza in surprise. "No, only when I'm happy."
"Are we not happy now?" asked John. "Christmas tide? You must sing for us, ma'am." "Does she sing, Ross?"
Francis inquired. Ross looked at Demelza, who shook her head vigorously.
"No," said Ross.
This denial seemed to carry no weight. Somebody must sing to them, and it looked as if it was going to be Demelza. The girl emptied her wine glass hurriedly, and someone refilled it.
"I only sing by myself," she said. "I mean, I don't rightly know proper tunes. Elizabeth must play first. Later, maybe?"
Elizabeth was very gently running her fingers up and down the harp. The faint rippling sound was a liquid accompaniment to the chatter.
"If you sing me a few bars," she said, "I think I could pick it up."
"No, no," said Demelza, backing away. "You first. You play first."
So presently Elizabeth played, and at once the company fell silent. Even the tipsy John and the well-soaked Francis. They were all Cornish, and music meant something to them. She played first a piece by Handel, and then a short sonatina by Krumpholz. The plucked, vibrating tones filled the room, and the only other sound was the murmur of burning wood from the fire. The candle glow fell on Elizabeth's young head, and on her slim hands moving over the strings. The light made a halo of her hair. Behind her stood George Warleggan, stocky and polite and ruthless, his hands behind his back, his eyes fixed unwinkingly on the player. Verity had subsided on a stool, a tray of glasses on the floor beside her. Against a background of blue moreen curtains, she sat with hands clasped about her knees, her head up, and showing the line of her throat above its lace fichu. Her face, in its repose, reminded one of the younger Verity, of 4 years ago. Next to her, Francis lolled in a chair, his eyes half closed, but listening. And beside him, Aunt Agatha chewed meditatively, a dribble of saliva at the corner of her mouth, listening too, but hearing nothing. In her finery, sharply different from the old lady, but having something strangely in common with her in the vitality of her manner, was Ruth Treneglas. One felt that she might be no beauty, but that she too would take some killing off when the time came. Next to her was Demelza, who had just finished her third glass of port, and was feeling better every minute. And beyond her, Ross stood, a little withdrawn, glancing now and then from one to another of the company with his unquiet eyes. John Treneglas was half listening to the music, half goggling at Demelza, who seemed to have a peculiar fascination for him. The music came to a stop, and Elizabeth leaned back, smiling at Ross. Applause was on the quieter note than could have been expected 10 minutes ago. The harp music had touched at something more fundamental than their high spirits. It had spoken not of Christmas jollity and fun, but of love and sorrow, of human life, its strange beginning and its inevitable end.
"Superb," declared George. "We were more than repaid for a ride 20 times as long. Elizabeth, you pluck at my heartstrings."
"Elizabeth," said Verity, "play me that canzonetta. As an encore, please. I love it."
"It is not good unless it's sung."
"Yes, yes, it is. Play it as you played it last Sunday night."
Silence fell again. Elizabeth played something very short by Mozart, and then a canzonetta by Haydn. There was silence when this was over, before anyone spoke.
"It is my favourite," said Verity. "I cannot hear it often enough."
"They're all my favourites," said George, "and played like an angel. One more, I beg you."
"No," said Elizabeth, smiling. "It's Demelza's turn. She will sing for us now." "After that, I could not," said Demelza, whom the last piece and the strong wine had much affected. "I was praying to God you had forgotten me."
Everyone laughed.
"We must hear this and go," said Ruth, with an eye on her husband. "Please, Mistress Poldark, overcome your modesty and satisfy us as to your attainments. We are all agog."
Demelza's eyes met those of the other girl, and saw in them a challenge. She rose to it. The port had given her Dutch courage.
"Well?"
With mixed feelings, Ross saw her walk across to the harp and sit down at the seat Elizabeth had left. She could not play a note on the instrument, but the instinct was sound which persuaded her to take up this position. The others were grouped round it to listen, and she was saved the awkwardness of standing with nothing to do with her hands. But 10 minutes ago was the time when she should have sung, when everyone was jolly and prepared to join in. Elizabeth's cultured, delicate playing had changed the atmosphere. The anticlimax would be certain. Demelza settled herself comfortably, straightening her back, and plucked at a string with her finger. The note it gave out was pleasing and reassuring. Contrast with Elizabeth. Gone was the halo, and in its place the dark crown of humanity. She looked at Ross. In her eyes was a demon of mischief. She began to sing. Her slightly husky voice, almost contralto, an imperceptible fraction off the note, and sweet-toned, made no effort to impress by volume. Rather, it seemed to confide